Good morning and welcome to today's edition of Times the Brief, brought to you by Spoken Layer. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day.
Donald Trump plans to allow release of long-blocked and classified JFK files. President Donald Trump says that he doesn't plan to block the scheduled release of thousands of never-publicly-seen government documents related to President John F. Kennedy's assassination. Trump says in a tweet that, subject to the receipt of further information, I will be allowing, as president, the long-blocked and classified JFK files to be opened. The National Archives has until next Thursday to disclose the remaining files related to Kennedy's 1963 assassination. But Trump could have blocked the release on the grounds that making the material public would harm intelligence, law enforcement, military operations, or foreign relations. The documents include more than 3,000 that have never been seen by the public and more than 30,000 that have been previously released, but with redactions.
Corporate outrage over monsters like Weinstein is too little too late. By Jerry Krause. The Weinstein Company Board of Representatives has claimed it was shocked and dismayed to learn from news reports that Harvey Weinstein, one of its owners and co-founders, had sexually harassed employees and actresses for decades. In response, it summarily fired him, announced it was seeking to change its name, and even began striking Mr. Weinstein's name off its television credits. While this response is justified, the fact that it comes only now suggests the company was more outraged by the exposure of the conduct than the conduct itself. Mr. Weinstein reportedly made payments to at least 8 women while he was at Miramax and the Weinstein Company, and lawyers and executives at the latter were aware of some of those payouts for at least the last 2 years. Where was the outrage then? The conduct was the same. The impact the conduct had on the accusers was the same. All that changed was the publicity. The real story here is not what the Weinstein Company is doing now, but what it and others in corporate America have been doing. Rather than investigate the complaints of sexual harassment by a powerful company executive and demand that it cease, companies have swept illegal conduct under the rug and allowed it to continue. Quite simply, the serious impact that the behavior caused to the alleged victims took a backseat to the importance of the accused harasser's power and value to the company. The Weinstein Company is far from the only offender. Fox News only parted with Roger Ailes and Bill O'Reilly once public exposure of allegations that had swirled or been known for decades created a public relations nightmare for the network. And the list goes on, and includes prominent entertainment figures, athletes, politicians, 2 presidents, and a Supreme Court justice. So long as our society continues to allow the dismissal of sexual harassment as locker room talk, or resents women for spoiling a boys-will-be-boys culture, no workplace will be immune from this problem. Since sexual harassment at its core is really about power, any employee, from the lowest paid to the highest, may fall victim when a boss or coworker uses their advantage of power over someone else's livelihood or career. Workplace sexual harassment is illegal, and the law provides protection to employees who report it. If the employer finds that the employee's complaint has merit, it must take appropriate steps to end the harassment without adversely affecting the work or position of the employee. But the law can only succeed if victims aren't afraid, despite the stated protections, to use it. And the practical reality is that few are, and those who do are frequently branded and humiliated by the alleged harasser or his supporters as liars, jilted, revengeful, or worse. In representing victims of discrimination and harassment for many years, all too often the company's response follows one of 2 routes: denial that the conduct occurred, or a conclusion after an investigation, to which only the company is privy, that the victim's allegations could not be substantiated. It's also not unusual to find that coworkers who witness the harassment are afraid to corroborate claims out of fear for their own jobs, particularly if the accused wields power over them as well. Other coworkers may turn on the accuser, upset that they're overreacting, threatening the position of a friend, or stifling the work environment. Sometimes a company may respond even more aggressively, and the complaining employee may find themselves accused of inappropriate behavior. And even if the company concludes that a monetary settlement is desirable, it will likely be conditioned on no admission of liability, strict confidentiality, and often an agreement that the employee leave the company and find new employment. Thus, despite legal protections, employees' fears that any accusation is more likely to further victimize them, their livelihood, and career are real. Many are simply not willing to take that personal risk. This practical reality allows sexual harassment to proliferate and prevents the anti-discrimination laws from achieving their goal of ridding the workplace of harassment and protecting employees against retaliation for reporting it. But this goal can be readily achieved if companies start demonstrating genuine outrage over exploitive and degrading behavior that has no place in the workplace, no matter who the harasser is. They must afford victims the dignity of taking their claims seriously. They must confront the harasser and take whatever steps necessary to protect their employees from the offensive behavior. By such actions, employees will learn that they need not fear speaking up, and this type of behavior will become much less prevalent. The real Halloween scare? The U.S. ran a $666 billion deficit last year. Americans haven't been spooked by government debt lately, but fate seems to have provided a Halloween-themed wake-up call. The Treasury Department announced Friday that the U.S. government ran a budget deficit of $666 billion in the 2017 fiscal year, which ended September 30th. That devilish number is an $80 billion increase from fiscal 2016. Though federal revenues are at an all-time high, expenditures grew even faster, producing a deficit equal to 3.5% of gross domestic product. This marks the second year in a row that the deficit rose as a percentage of GDP, following steady declines between 2009 and 2015. According to the Treasury Department, the increase in expenditures was driven by entitlements such as Social Security and Medicare, as well as the rising cost of financing outstanding debt. A rise in interest rates paid on the federal debt could drastically change the national conversation on government spending. Public concern about the nation's budget deficit has waned in recent years, in part because stimulus spending following the financial crisis was deemed a necessary evil by many, but also because low interest rates have made financing the debt more affordable. Now that the economy has been stabilized, conventional economic wisdom says it's time to shrink the deficit. But current law would continue growing the national deficit, which the Congressional Budget Office recently projected could reach nearly 90% of GDP by 2027. While that is high debt level by global standards, it could still be sustainable for an economy as robust as America's. Japan's national debt, by comparison, is more than 200% of GDP, and that nation still receives solid ratings from credit agencies. But the CBO's projections do not account for tax reforms currently being planned by President Donald Trump and the Republican-controlled legislature. Trump's history of embracing debt as a business tool seems to have extended into his views on the federal budget, and he has promised huge tax cuts intending to chase extremely ambitious GDP growth targets. Trump's Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin has said economic growth spurred by lower tax rates would offset losses to federal revenue and actually reduce the debt. Most economists don't buy that resurrection of supply-side or trickle-down budget logic, with the majority of 26 surveyed by Bloomberg saying a version of the tax plan floated last month would increase both annual deficits and the total national debt even more dramatically.
Let's be real for a second. These days, many of us live in a world of excess, where more is definitely better. We heap our plates full with seconds when we're already full, overstuff a drawer with t-shirts we'll never wear again, and ensure that we own at least 20 mugs. I know, each of those mugs serves a very specific purpose. Often we apply this more is more principle to our professional lives too. Clocking in at the crack of dawn and logging off only when our eyelids can't stay open anymore are often heralded as hallmarks of star employees. But I have news for you. This type of lifestyle is not necessary for success, growth, or job satisfaction. In fact, I'd argue that it can actually hurt you, but that's a story for a different day. The main message here is you can be the apple of your manager's eye even if you don't make working overtime a habit. Provided, of course, that when you're in the office, you're kicking ass, completing everything assigned and turning it in on time. Ready to start leaving before dinner time? I recommend making these three things habits. 1. Stay engaged. I used to bring my laptop to every single meeting, and without a doubt, I'd spend the entire time answering emails, surfing random sites, and chatting with friends. Now that I work in an office where this isn't the norm, I realize just how annoying it is. A surefire way to signal that you don't care about your job or your teammates, even if that isn't necessarily true, is to spend your time with them with your eyes glued to a screen. Instead, be present in meetings and all other conversations you have. Ask questions, provide helpful feedback and context, and flex those active listening muscles. And yes, this applies to remote workers too. Working off-site doesn't mean you're off the hook when it comes to communication. If anything, you'll probably need to make a bit more of an effort. But it's worth it if it means you're staying in the loop and others are too. 2. Know when to say yes and when to say no. Lending a colleague a hand or volunteering to take the lead on a new project are invaluable characteristics. And there's an added bonus if you can anticipate needs and offer your services before someone needs to ask. It'll show that you're a go-getter, a team player, and someone who wants to learn and grow. It's a big plus for a supervisor if his staff isn't constantly muttering, "That's not my job." But this doesn't in any way mean you should be a yes person. It's also crucial to know when and how to turn down requests for help, new assignments, and so forth. Putting too much on your plate is a recipe for becoming severely overwhelmed. You may start producing shoddy work or missing deadlines completely, and, well, neither of those are invaluable characteristics. The key is knowing not just how much you can fit on your plate, but how much you can execute at a high-quality rate. So if you're at the point in which you can feel yourself starting to slip, say no. Not comfortable with saying no? This strategy will help. 3. Check in with your boss regularly. In each position I've had, my manager and I met regularly. And I admit these times weren't always helpful. Sometimes it was because my supervisor always canceled them. Thanks. But other times it was because I just wanted it to be over as quickly as possible, so I didn't say much. That was a mistake. This one-on-one time is so important. It's your time to update her on your progress, ask for help, discuss career goals, and get to know each other a little bit better. Taking these meetings seriously will reassure your boss that you are, in fact, doing what you're supposed to be doing, and it will also signal that you care. And caring is a big part of being a good employee. If you're stumped about what to talk about in a one-on-one meeting, these questions may help you get started. And hey, if you don't have regular time like this on your calendar, I highly recommend requesting it. Yes, there will be occasions in which you need to put in a little extra time, but that doesn't have to be an ongoing theme in your life. I'm here to tell you that you can be a rock star employee and live a life outside of work. This article was posted by Abby Wolf, The Muse. When it comes to flying, nothing about a close proximity to strangers and bathrooms for hours on end feels particularly clean. And while you may not be able to make the flight shorter or the seats bigger, you can make your experience more sanitary by avoiding some of the dirtiest places on airplanes. It's worth noting that some people may be more susceptible to getting sick on planes because the cabin air humidity is under 20%, whereas home humidity is generally over 30%, according to the World Health Organization. The dry air exposure affects mucus, the immune system's front line of defense, leaving people marginally more vulnerable to getting sick. A 2004 study in the Journal of Environmental Health Research found that people are far more likely, 113 times more, by one of the study's measures, to catch a common cold during a flight than normal ground transmission. Humidity aside, there are a handful of especially dirty spots, according to research and advisories from travel physicians. Here's how to avoid them. Airplane tray tables. The potentially grimiest place on an airplane unfolds right into your lap. Alarmingly, a 2015 study by Travel Math that tested samples from hard surfaces and planes found that tray table surfaces had more than 8 times the amount of bacteria per square inch than the lavatory flush buttons. The trays had 2,155 colony-forming units of bacteria per square inch, compared to the 127 CFU per square inch, which is what the National Science Foundation says is standard for a toilet seat at home. Dr. Charles Gerber, microbiologist at the University of Arizona, tells Time that the trays he's tested through research have had cold viruses, human parafluenza viruses, norovirus, which causes diarrhea and vomiting, and the superbug MRSA, which causes skin infections. The high amount of bacteria is likely linked to plane cleaning crews not having enough time between flights to wipe down the tray tables, the Wall Street Journal reports, and when they do get clean, those airlines may be using general cleaners instead of disinfectants. In the meantime, to avoid eating dinner off a tray that someone piled used tissues or changed a baby's diaper on just hours earlier, wipe it down with a sanitizing wipe. Dr. Michael Zimring, director of travel medicine at Baltimore's Mary Medical Center, tells Time. But if you don't feel like even touching the table, Gerber does, but Zimring says he doesn't bother. Avoid eating food directly off the surface. My food will stay on a paper plate or wrapper, says Zimring. Air vents and seat belt buckles. Two plain features with frequent usage that may not receive a regular cleaning also make the list. The air vents above each seat are great for circulating ventilated air to each passenger, but the Travel Math testing found 285 CFU per square inch in one dial, more bacteria than on the plain toilet flush buttons. The seat belt buckles similarly had 230 FCU per square inch, which isn't surprising since every passenger touches their buckles at least 2 times during the flight. Gerber recommends bringing a small bottle of hand sanitizer on the plane and using it periodically. Restrooms. Airplane bathrooms are cleaned regularly. United, Delta, and American Airlines told the Journal that they get disinfected overnight and between long flights. But Gerber points out with roughly 50 people to a bathroom, there's still an easy way to pick up an infection. He found the fecal coli form E. coli on some of the sinks, flush handles, and toilet seats he tested. Travel Math found that the flush buttons had 265 CFU per square inch, but no fecal coli bacteria. It's hard to beat the restroom in terms of germiness, Gerber says, because the water shuts off so people can't complete hand washing. The sinks are so small, he adds, that people with large hands can't even fit them fully underneath the faucets. Zimmering recommends using a paper towel on the door latch on the way out and says that's the one precaution he never fails to take. Seat back pocket. Passengers have been known to treat the pocket on the seat in front of them as a wastebasket, stuffing trash, dirty tissues, used diapers, and more into the pouch. On planes with quick turnarounds on the ground, cleaning crews may not even get a chance to empty out the seat pockets, let alone disinfect the cloth. And one Auburn University in Alabama study found that MRSA germs survive for up to 7 days on seat pocket cloth, the longest it survives on any of the hard and soft surfaces the researchers tested. Drexel University Medicine only recommends one way to avoid germs in the seat back pocket. Just don't use them. It's simply not worth the risk. Aisle seats. Choosing the aisle seat lets you get up whenever you feel like it, but that freedom comes with a little more risk. The tops of aisle seats are likely harboring germs from every person who walks by them and holds on for support, according to Zimmering. And many of those people have just come from the bathroom. So be aware of touching the area next to the aisle headrest, and it's probably best to not rest your face there as you fall asleep. Sitting near the aisle puts passengers in the line of fire of any communicable viruses that could break out on the plane. One study published in Clinical Infectious Diseases analyzed a flight from Boston to L.A. that made an emergency landing due to an outbreak of vomiting and diarrhea. The researchers found that people sitting in the aisles were far more likely to contract norovirus, but there was no link between contracting it and using the bathrooms. If you sit by the window seat, you have less chance of getting sick, Gerber confirms. This article was posted by Julia Zorthane.
Scott Pruitt casts doubt on EPA document showing the dangers of climate change, by Justin Warland. Environmental Protection Agency Chief Scott Pruitt questioned the legitimacy of a key scientific document on the dangers of climate change, but he does not plan to formally consider reversing it anytime soon. The finding, a 2009 EPA document that said man-made climate change harms human health, has had a major impact on EPA policy, driving Obama-era regulations on power plants. Because of a Supreme Court ruling, the document means the EPA must address climate change by regulating carbon dioxide emissions. In an interview with Time this week, Pruitt cast doubt on the validity of the EPA finding. Did this agency engage in a robust, meaningful discussion with respect to the endangerment that CO2 poses to this country? Pruitt asked about the 2009 document, known as an endangerment document. I think by any definition of that process, they didn't. But Pruitt did not go so far as to say that he would seek to overturn the document's conclusions in an upcoming reevaluation of how the agency regulates carbon dioxide emissions, as some hardline conservatives had hoped. That means the EPA will remain legally required to reduce carbon emissions. Still, regardless of those requirements, Pruitt has no intention of implementing strong climate regulations. Instead, he suggested to Time that he plans to limit the scope of the EPA's climate rules through legal arguments that sidestep the need to question mainstream climate science. He declined to rule out formally questioning climate science in the future. Pruitt's primary target is the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan, which aimed to reduce carbon dioxide emissions from power plants. Pruitt recently formalized his intent to scrap the Clean Power Plan and will argue that the EPA does not have the authority to enforce it. That narrow legal argument may not become a rallying point for deniers of climate change, but it is easier to defend in court than a broader case that questions the science of global warming. A lot of people start with the endangerment finding and the scientific questions about the underpinnings of that, Pruitt says. They don't ask about what authority we have to do it, and both are very important. Leaving the endangerment finding untouched means that legally, Pruitt needs to replace the Clean Power Plan, or at least begin a process to do so. Speaking to Time, Pruitt remained silent on the details of a potential replacement, saying that the agency would first evaluate its authority to regulate carbon dioxide emissions. Pruitt is planning separate processes to roll back the rule and figure out how to replace it. Many environmental experts fear that Pruitt is trying to evade issuing a new rule altogether by dragging out the bureaucratic process. Pruitt offered a mixed message this week, saying that he believes there is some modest authority for us to take action to regulate power plants, but also that such authority is yet to be determined. We've been spending many months evaluating Section 111 of the Clean Air Act to ask and answer the question what authority exists, says Pruitt. That is ongoing and will be ongoing for months into the future. Industry groups have called for the EPA to issue a replacement soon, saying a long process creates uncertainty that's bad for business. Environmental groups will inevitably sue if Pruitt declines to issue a replacement. The EPA's 2009 endangerment finding increases their chances of victory. Virtually everyone in the business community believes that EPA needs to issue a replacement rule. Jeff Homestead, a former senior EPA official under George W. Bush, who now represents energy companies, wrote in an email, "They think they would be better off with a reasonable regulation than with no regulation at all."
Five Things You Should Never Order from Room Service by Perry Ormont. While room service can often elicit luxurious connotations, breakfast in bed anyone? A lackluster pile of soggy fries can also be a real drag. Here, insiders dish on what to steer clear of on the room service menu. Spaghetti and meatballs. Pasta water is a thickening agent which can water down sauces, offers Pilot Mountain, North Carolina resident Kelly Merritt, author of The Everything Family Guide to Budget Travel and Flight. But since there's no quieting a spaghetti and meatballs craving, try Merritt's simple trick. If I see pasta and meatballs on a room service menu, I love to order a side of crust, crispy, buttery bread, and a side of meatballs. This is almost always enough to be filling, and the best part is you get the savory fix without the pasta watering, diluting the sauce. Ask for any cheese, like mozzarella or parmesan, to be served on the side. Anything fried. We hate to be the bearer of bad news, but it's hard to preserve items in this food category, both texture and taste-wise. Vented lids cause crispy items like fries, onion rings, or even fried shrimp to get soggy from the steam. Comments Skip Warden, executive chef at Weston Jekyll Island in Georgia. To avoid the soggy fry syndrome, you can request your batch to be extra crispy or even burnt, but we make no promises. Steamed vegetables. Those limp, lackluster sides of veggies simply aren't worth a price tag. Items like broccoli and even squash and carrots sweat under a hospitality cover and become nothing more than flat colors on a plate by the time they reach a guest room, advises Merritt. If you're in the mood for vegetables, try a crudité platter with hummus or even salad dressing, which is pretty tough to mess up. Pizza. Many people will not order fried food off a room service menu because chances are it won't be very crispy when it arrives. I feel this way about ordering pizza, chimes in Gian Nicola Colucci, executive chef at the Four Seasons Hotel in St. Louis. Unless the hotel has an Italian restaurant or is known for its pizza, there's a good chance that it will be previously frozen or a bit tired from sitting under a heat lamp. What's more, pizza can be a vehicle for using up ingredients on the brink of going bad as toppings. Eggs. Because of temperature issues, it's best to place your order for other breakfast fare. Eggs can get cold pretty quickly. Stick to pancakes, French toast, or hot cereals, which retain their heat longer and don't suffer too much from the steam buildup, explains Warden.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.